Welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Blanchett. Today's episode is the third in a four-part series on long-acting antiretroviral medications for both the treatment and prevention of HIV infection. The series features international panel discussions among Dr. Christina Mussini from Italy, Dr. Yvonne Galise from the United Kingdom, and Dr. Daryl Tan from Canada, each led by Dr. Babafemi Taiwo from the United States. In this episode, our expert faculty discuss key considerations for incorporating long-acting cabotegravir as an additional HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, option for appropriate individuals at high risk of acquiring HIV. Topics addressed in the discussion include anticipated patient interest in this new paradigm, the role of the oral lead-in phase, new guideline recommendations for monitoring during PrEP, patient care and follow-up after PrEP discontinuation, and remaining unanswered questions about this new strategy. For more information about our guests and for additional online education on this topic, please visit the link in the show notes. So now, let's turn it over to Dr. Taiwo and the faculty panel.
Okay, so the next thing we're going to address is long-acting PrEP. This is something that really is paradigm shifting because we've been using oral therapies for oral agents for PrEP until the advent of long-acting cabotegravir, which is now entering clinics in the United States. So let me ask our colleagues who are not from the United States, which is actually every other person on this panel. And I'm going to start with Christina. Is there access to this new treatment or new prevention modality in your neck of the woods?
No, we don't have the access to long acting because it's not registered in EU now. I have to say that we found a lot of difficulties in PrEP reimbursement from a political point of view. We all have PrEP ambulatories and the patient are paying out of pocket for oral generic tenofovir and FTC, but there is not yet the reimbursement. But it's just political, because when we will get reimbursement, since long-acting cabotegravir reached superiority, I think that it won't be a huge problem. But it's just, as I said, it's political. And I have a huge envy to Yvonne, because I know that the UK is much, much more progressive than Italy.
Do you want to comment, Yvonne?
So we are reimbursed for PrEP now. So it's tenofovir FTC PrEP, and that's standard in clinics now. I think we'll say whether the UK is as desirable, because we're not under the EU directive anymore. That's another discussion. But I do think that it's something that there's a huge uptake of within our clinics, and we don't have access to long-acting PrEP. And I guess for me, the most exciting option when this becomes available, because it's been proven so effective, will be in women. And that's where I think the role of long-acting PrEP is really going to have a wider audience. It may not necessarily be in all of our clinics, but certainly globally, I think that's where this is going. So yeah, introducing the option to patients, I think we have lots of patients in our sexual health clinics who need injections, say for syphilis, so they're used to having injections. So I think introducing this idea to patients, I think we will have a lot of people who will be interested, again, because of the interval between dosing.
Right. Now, you talked about the potential for this to be transformative in the options available to women. What about women do you think leads you to that conclusion? Can you elaborate a little bit more? And then maybe talk about the issue of its use in women who want to have babies. And certainly we have data that shows some evidence of no concerning signal, but can you just address those areas?
So historically, if we look at all the pre-exposure prophylaxis data in women, whether we're talking about vaginal gels, oral medication, even I would say dapivirine ring, I think the results are far lower than we would want. And certainly I, as a physician, would want for a woman who needs PrEP attending my clinic. I think we have this amazing data showing specifically in women who are being given long-acting cabotegravir as PrEP, it is really efficacious and really acceptable for women. So this is, you know, for me, this is the superior form of PrEP for women. And I think whether or not women want to conceive, obviously anyone coming into a trial is asked not to conceive. But within this study, what we have seen is women who have become pregnant on cabotegravir and have wanted to stay on it within this and other studies, they are still being followed. And we have not seen a safety signal that there is a problem with cabotegravir and pregnancy. And therefore, continuing to monitor these women and babies' outcomes very closely is going to continue to enhance that data for us. So I'm very excited about long-acting PrEP as a new treatment modality for women who need PrEP. A, because it's efficacious, it's acceptable, but also women are in control of it. And where there's a risk of domestic violence, particularly at home, women don't have to keep or hide drugs or a ring or use something around the time of sex to protect themselves from HIV. This is something they can go to a clinic for, and the medication is outside of the home, therefore not discoverable, but they are in control. So very exciting.
Well, terrific. Very strong endorsement, Yvonne, for consideration of this in cisgender women. And clearly, we also have data in MSM and also transgender women showing superiority. And I think that in a population like mine, which really comprises about 85% men, I do not expect lower levels of enthusiasm amongst my patients who are either MSM or transgender females. So really a great leading into what I'm going to ask Daryl to talk about, which is, now, first of all, Daryl, what's the situation in Canada? Do you have this available?
Once again, unfortunately, we do not yet.
Right. I'll say that even in the United States, though, it's available, but its availability is just beginning to increase. And we're not too worried about that, because right now we're trying to really begin to operationalize or assimilate the treatment option, the cabotegravir repurposing treatment option, dealing with all the logistics, and this is also now being added, but very exciting overall. Now, we covered quite a bit of what to tell patients in terms of what they should expect when they were going to get an injection with cabotegravir rilpivirine. Are there any differences with this when you're thinking about just its use for PrEP, right? Is there any different consideration in terms of what a patient should expect regarding the injections? I'm thinking in my own mind as I'm talking to you, for any specific differences, none really comes to my head right away. But can you think of any particular difference that we didn't cover initially from an injection standpoint?
I think, Bokhtemi, what I might say is just that I think in some ways the science is just a tiny bit younger on the prevention front. And as such, there are probably a few other unanswered questions so far that by analogy to the treatment setting, we might hope we could learn more about in the future. And really what I'm referring to is the issue of the PrEP failing, right? We know that this is an extraordinarily effective intervention, as Yvonne has already highlighted, really, you know, superiority over a very effective oral comparator in the two pivotal trials. So that's fantastic. And yet it is once again not bulletproof. So we have seen very, very rare true failures that have been carefully characterized by the investigators of those two HPTN trials, and I'm sure more data will be forthcoming. And so we still don't quite understand how it is or why it is that certain individuals have had what looks like true breakthrough HIV infection despite receiving injections on time. So as those data come out, I think we might start to have hints as to what the risk factors for failure are, whether they're viral factors or host factors, what have you. So I think we should just be keeping our eye out for those data. They're going to trickle in slowly because the numbers are necessarily quite small. So not something that we can speak to our patients about in concrete terms yet, but just important for us to recognize that, like so many other things, this isn't quite bulletproof.
Right. And that idea that a very few number of patients did develop acquired infection despite on-time injection is something that, for me, gave me a little pause. Because in the past, if a patient told me they were taking their medication, their oral medication, 100% on time and still got infected, I might have looked at them and said, are you really sure? Are you really, 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 really sure you never missed a dose? And I suspect some of them actually were telling me the truth when they said they never absolutely missed a dose, but still acquired infection. But there is a case where we do have a demonstration of that in what was really directly observed as therapy. But this has affected our approach to treatment, or to monitoring, in that HIV RNA testing is now recommended by the CDC, certainly as part of the monitoring of patients who receive this particular injection for prevention of HIV. And so let me go back to Christina. What is the situation in Italy? Is that also what your approach is going to be, that if you're getting this particular approach, you should have not just the antigen antibody fourth generation testing that we used to do serially, but also get HIV RNA testing, either done qualitatively or done quantitatively as part of monitoring?
Yes, actually, we are looking into it because with both options, either the long-acting but also the tenofovir FTC, they have seen that there is a prolonged time before becoming positive with the ELISA test. So I think that it's mandatory to use HIV RNA. And also the idea is that if you detect very early seroconversion, maybe you could have a lower incidence with cabotegravir integrase resistance, but also of resistance to NRTIs. So I think we definitely should move there. We have to check because now, while the patient in Italy, while the patient is paying for the generic tenofovir FTC, all the exams are for free under an umbrella-like prevention. Okay, we have so they are not asked to pay for these exams. I don't know if HIV RNA could fall in the same definition, but if the CDC guidelines has changed as they did, I think that we will provide this for free too.
Right. Those are excellent points. And of course, based on the studies that we've already been talking about, then in fact, was shown that using RNA would have led to earlier detection, which is really why the field has moved in this direction. And there are, of course, considerations like cost that you just mentioned. Yvonne, do you have any contributions on this whole area of HIV RNA testing? Will you be actually doing it in both? Just to put it in context, the CDC now says that it's recommended not just in patients who are on long-acting therapy, but the CDC is also recommending HIV RNA testing along with antigen antibody testing in patients who are on oral PrEP. So the impact of this study has just not been localized to long-acting PrEP. It's actually affected our entire approach to care. And I've heard some providers give some pushback about doing it in every patient. Do you have any thoughts on all of this debate?
So this is something we are reviewing too. I think we have, given the number of the volume of patients we have on oral PrEP currently, and having not used HIV and RNA testing so far, it's something that we're reviewing at the moment, and we're looking at individuals who have become positive on oral PrEP to see, was there anything else other than adherence potentially that could have been a risk factor for seroconversion versus not seroconverting. I think for long-acting injectables, I think because we're a little bit behind, we will see what's happening within the US given the new CDC guidance. I think by the time we get long-acting PrEP, we'll probably have more of an idea of how that's working for you. But I certainly think in the context of long-acting PrEP, it probably is something that we would consider more seriously because of the risk of the resistance that might be seen. And also, I guess, because of our lack of use of it in the general test treating context as well. I think the familiarity that we will need will give us potentially confidence to change what we're doing. But at the moment, we would look at RNA testing within that group.
Excellent, excellent. And one thing that we also have to keep in mind that will definitely impact our practice going forward is the occurrence of occasion of HIV infection in someone who has a history or who was on cabotegravir PrEP. And remember that we know that in men, cabotegravir can actually be detectable in plasma at very low levels for up to 3 years after the last dose. In women, it might even be longer, even be 4 years. So if somebody acquires HIV after being exposed to PrEP, even if it's a year or two or maybe even longer afterwards, one cannot absolutely exclude the possibility of them having, you know, cabotegravir or integrase mutations. Hopefully they don't, but one couldn't exclude it, which means it will impact what one might select for treatment. If you're using, if you're going to start treatment before resistance testing is available. And I think the US guidelines is going to move towards recommending a boosted PI-based regimen in patients who acquire HIV infection after prior exposure to long-acting cabotegravir. What do you think about that, Daryl?
Yeah, I mean, I think on its face, it's a very logical sort of argument to make in these early days. I think the other issue that it speaks to, though, is that as we start to think about rolling out long-acting cabotegravir PrEP programs, I think we need to be planning in advance, once again, with our patients about how we'll try to retain them in some sense, even beyond their use of PrEP. We've always talked about how PrEP for many people is often going to be a time-limited intervention, that the people go through seasons of risk and this may change over time. And I think that's going to be true for in any form of PrEP, whether it's injectable or oral. But because of these issues around the tail and the concern around potential HIV incident infections developing or harboring integrase resistance, I think, you know, the ideal situation would be that there is some engagement and care with the provider still after discontinuing their PrEP care, whether that's a primary care provider that's going to maintain a long-term relationship with that person, even if the relationship with the sexual health clinic or the HIV or infectious diseases clinic ends, or what have you. Ideally, there's some way that folks can be retained in care just to try to mitigate this risk. The last thing to say about it is, of course, that if our systems work well, then hopefully we avoid this circumstance altogether, right? Someone who has had access to PrEP in the past, you know, and if they come off of PrEP, let's make sure that that happens in a deliberate way, and that if they do find themselves in a situation where they're at risk once again in the future, that they do manage to get on PrEP of some form at that point, and that we don't have incident infections. That would really be a failure of the system if that were to happen.
Right, right. And of course, the scenario that I described, if one were to start, one had a patient with a history of exposure to long-acting cabotegravir PrEP, got infected, unfortunately, for some reason, while waiting for resistance testing, it's going to be, you know, use a boosted PI-based regimen. And then, but if you have the resistance results eventually and it looks like they don't have resistance mutations, certainly you can go back to integrase. Just wanted to make that clear. This is really a fascinating discussion, very complex, different areas. There's also the issue about, you know, oral lead-in versus no oral lead-in. We do have some experience now, sadly from the cabotegravir rilpivirine combination, that we don't need the oral lead-in. Let's remember why we were doing it in the treatment context initially. One was the concern about allergic reaction, right? You didn't want to, that's a main thing. You didn't want to go and put a depot of a medication in the patient who was allergic to it, and also concern that you may not have adequate levels and probably expose patients to risk. And we know that from the treatment perspective, that hasn't panned out. So I think overall, that's a similar approach is where we would land for the injectable in the context of prevention. Now, I know that you still don't have this. Are there important things about PrEP, long-acting PrEP with cabotegravir that we haven't touched on that you think it's important for everyone that is contemplating adopting this in their practice? Or even patients who are listening to this discussion. Anything that we have missed? Let me start with Christina. Anything that you'd like to add?
No, I think that what Yvonne said at the beginning of the importance in women is really relevant. The problem is that women, in most of the cases, they don't require PrEP, even if they should need it. This is at least a situation in Italy. So I hope that this with this new formulation, maybe we could overcome this problem.
I think that's a terrific note to end on. And in my mind, what you're describing is that the availability of a new paradigm shifting approach, such as the cabotegravir plus rilpivirine for treatment, or the cabotegravir for long acting for prevention. Availability does not always translate into adoption. And there's a gap between that in implementation, which we hope will be different this time. And that this regimen will be something that's available to help us bridge gaps that we have in the availability of agents for all patients at risk or currently living with HIV. So we can end there. And thanks everyone for your wonderful contributions.
Thank you, Dr. Taiwo and faculty panel, for sharing your insights with us. And thank you for listening. Look out for more episodes in this series at clinicaloptions.com/HIV.